Okay, so let's start. Again, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining this conversation today entitled The New International Climate Finance Goal: Where Does the EU Stand? My name is Emilia Runeberg. I am the Climate and Development Policy Coordinator at CAN Europe. And I'll provide a brief background for our discussion today. The upcoming climate negotiations in Azerbaijan in November this year, the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change are to decide on a new goal for financing climate action in developing countries. This new goal, known as the New Collective Quantified Goal on Climate Finance, or by the acronym NCQG, it's to build on the existing goal of developed countries to mobilize $100 billion per year for developing countries' mitigation and adaptation action. So we know technical negotiations have been held for years now, but unfortunately, very little progress has been made. All the while, the climate crisis worsens, and we hear about devastating impacts on a daily basis. Now we only have 6 weeks to go until COP29 in Baku, and parties' views are still far apart when it comes to how much money should be put on the table, what type of actions it should fund, what kind of money would be acceptable, and who should pay, among other questions. Looking at the EU in all of this, next week, Tuesday, the EU ministers of finance will meet at the ECOFIN Council, where they will be adopting their conclusions on international climate finance that will provide the negotiation mandate for the EU for Baku. The EU will now definitely need to show strong leadership and considerably step up its finance provisions. So, for this timely discussion, I'm happy to be joined by three experts from around the globe. We have here CAN Europe's Director, Chiara Martinelli. We have Dr. Sindra Sharma, who is Senior Policy Advisor at the Pacific Islands Climate Action Network. And finally, we have Jan Kowalczyk, who is Senior Policy Advisor at Climate Change at Oxfam, Germany. So before we jump into the discussion, if you have any questions while we're talking, please tweet them to @CANEurope throughout the session. We have about 30 minutes for this discussion, so we'll be able to take a few questions at the end. So the first question goes to Sindra Sharma from Pacific Islands Climate Action Network. You work on also for the Loss and Damage Collaboration, that is a network of researchers, practitioners, and artists, CSOs, and etc., who are involved in looking at climate change impacts and especially the loss and damage it causes. Can you, Sindra, describe also from your perspective, with your longstanding research and working in small island developing states, what is the upcoming climate finance decision? What does it represent for communities in the global south?
Thank you so much, Emilia, for that question and also for the invitation to the space. So for us, the urgency has been growing for years now as action has really lagged behind what is needed. And this isn't new. So our people have suffered as the planet continues to warm, approaching that ever-critical threshold of 1.5. And actually, we've already lived in a world that has been 1.5 warmer for a year, right? And we see across the world and in the EU as well, the devastation and extremes of cascading impacts and also the uncertainty for the future that that brings. When the Pacific raised the slogan of 1.5 to stay alive, it wasn't just a slogan, it's our reality. So if you speak to someone from Tuvalu or Kiribati or our displaced communities in Fiji or Vanuatu or really just across the Pacific, you'll hear the devastation firsthand. And the vulnerability is really very real. In the Pacific in 2018, our forum leaders, which actually also includes Australia and New Zealand, declared climate change as the single greatest security threat to our region. And this was the BOI Declaration. Vulnerable nations in the global south, like ours, have been sending a clear call to action. Those least responsible for climate change are shouldering the heaviest burdens, while developed countries have been falling short on their commitments. So the urgency, again, is really undeniable, and the EU can be a real champion and leader if it supports the delivery of new, additional, predictable, and adequate finance to developing countries by developed countries. And this must prioritize grants and concessional finance for loss and damage, adaptation, and mitigation, ensuring equity and transparency in line with their historical responsibilities. And these needs have been calculated as in the trillions annually. So why is this so urgent? By 2030, loss and damage costs alone for developing countries has been estimated between 400 to 700 billion annually. And for Pacific nations, this is really existential. So in 2023, when the twin tropical cyclones hit Vanuatu, one after the other, this nearly cost 40% of its GDP. People are trapped in this endless cycle of recovery, and finance does go towards this recovery, but it's not really building the development needs of the country, right? You're always recovering. And how can we achieve these thriving societies, not just for today, but for future generations without fair finance? As we see fossil fuel expansion continue, every degree of warming intensifies our suffering. And we see rising seas, stronger storms. These are the bigger things that we see, but the slow erosion of our lands, of our culture, of our spirit, this is happening every day. The new goal to be agreed in a few short weeks really must deliver new, predictable, and grant-based finance from developed to developing countries for adaptation, mitigation, and loss and damage. And yes, this is in the trillions. And it's really about survival. It's not charity. It's about equity. And it's also about legal obligations that are enshrined within the text of the convention and also the Paris Agreement. Without strong financial commitments, we'll definitely be overshooting that 1.5 target, that 1.5 to stay alive. And the impacts will be irreversible. Loss and damage for us must be recognized as a third pillar of climate action alongside adaptation and mitigation, as this has consistently been articulated by the South as a critical need as well. And we would really like the EU to support developing countries' proposals around this as well. It's a moral obligation, and it's also a legal obligation for developed countries that is actually within the Convention and Paris Agreement. And the cost of inaction, when you think about poverty, displacement, economic collapse, and the list continues, will really far exceed the cost of addressing this crisis. So developed countries like the EU, by upholding their commitments, by acting first, going furthest and going fastest, they can enable others to follow suit, and we can have a more hopeful future for our future generations as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Sindra. And to all our listeners, if you have just joined us, please tweet any questions you have to @CanEurope. We're discussing international climate finance and the upcoming decisions in COP29 and the role and responsibility of the EU in all of this. Next, I'll turn to our second speaker, Janko Waldsiig. So we just heard that the needs are manifold. And we heard that the needs are in the trillions of dollars annually in developing countries to cope with and adapt to climate change. So what has the EU come forward with in these finance negotiations thus far? What do you know about the EU's position, and what are the chances that the EU will commit sufficient amounts, and what would sufficient amounts from the EU even be?
Thanks. Thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure to speak with you. The European Union has acknowledged in its positioning around the negotiations on the new global collective goal for climate finance that a key component has to be the provision and mobilization of support. So similar in the ways this was done or is being done in the context of the current goal, the 100 billion a year goal set by developed countries in 2009. So similar to that, apparently the EU wants a component or accepts that the new goal will have such a component as well. So that's in itself is good, even though the design of the 100 billion goal has attracted a lot of criticisms also from our side. But in principle, recognizing that the need for something like that is, I think, a positive step. But the European Union so far has refused to indicate a quantum for this. So how much is the EU thinking developing countries would need or would be given through or would be supported with under this new goal? And that's a huge problem because it deadlocks the negotiations on a successful outcome of COP29 if one side of the talks doesn't indicate what their planned level of ambition is. So that's a huge problem. You mentioned it, and Sindra spoke to that as well. The needs are dramatically higher than the 100 billion goal that what we have now. When you look at the estimates and the available literature, you get to, or you conclude, you might conclude that the needs are at least, and that's conservative, at least $1 trillion a year in external public grant finance. That is, and that's again, being very conservative, at least a factor of 10 more than what's currently being provided. And I say that's really the bottom of the needs or the bottom estimate of the needs. It's probably much higher than that, but just like to give them something to imagine, at least increase by a factor of 10. And that's not what we are hearing from the European Union, or an acknowledgement of the fact or of these estimates that exist, nor do we hear it from other developed countries. And as I said, this is a huge problem that is created or that we see unfolding in these negotiations. We hear a lot from European Union. We speak to delegates from various countries in the EU that they talk about political realities that doesn't allow that don't allow to increase support much more than to higher levels, much higher than what we currently have. But that doesn't help us, or that's the gap that the COP29 needs to bridge. Recognizing these are the needs that we need to fulfill somehow. And rather than refusing to talk about it, it will be better to talk about what are the ways that can get us to achieving and fulfilling those needs. And that's what the COP29 actually needs to do, recognize the needs and then agreeing on steps how to reach it or how to close this gap. And that must include, and Sindra has spoken to that and the reasons for that, through developed country contributions. I don't need to go into that as well. So that's, of course, obviously the key ingredient to that. We also need to look into dramatically enhanced MDB financing. We also need to talk about new sources that can be tapped into, such as the G20 presidency proposal for global minimum tax on the world's billionaires, and others on fossil fuel extraction, you name it. There's many ideas of these new sources that could be globally agreed to install or to set up, and then task the relevant authorities to implement them, and ensuring, obviously, that the income of such sources would go into financing climate action in the developing countries. On the EU, more what we lament is in their positioning is that they currently refuse to accept that support to address loss and damage would be part of the new goal. And they insist that it would only cover, and they argue with formalities that the mandate doesn't allow that and so forth, that it would only cover supporting adaptation and mitigation. But we take it that dealing with loss and damage is the third pillar of implementing the Paris Agreement. Sindra has spoken to that. I don't need to repeat that. We can't ignore the needs in vulnerable countries for that. So any goal that is even remotely taking into account the needs of developing countries must also include addressing loss and damage as one of the thematic areas of this that the new goal would cover. A few or two more things about the European Union's position, as far as we understand it or can understand it from the submissions they make, is it seems that the EU is currently by and large okay with the current suite of financial instruments that are being used in supporting developing countries. While these countries at the same time rightly argue that financing needs to be way more grant-based, way more concessional than it currently is in order to avoid that climate finance worsens the already crushing debt levels in many of these developing countries. So that's something we wish, or we would like the EU to speak more in favor of, ensuring that the future instruments deal with the debt issue of developing countries way more than that's been the past. Maybe I leave it at that in order not to use more time, but I'm happy to take more questions then.
Thank you, Jan. So based on what you said and what we know, just a follow-up question on the EU's position, and you mentioned the debt crisis and the different instruments that the EU, among others, are using to channel this money. It seems the EU is counting on the private sector and loans to come to the rescue and to close this finance gap. Is that right? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's the argument we're usually hearing, saying there's not enough public money. Therefore, we need to talk about making the money that's there go further, and they then mobilizing loans, for instance, rather than providing grants, or involving the private sector. And there's nothing wrong with making sure, on the contrary, it's absolutely necessary to make sure the private sector also engages in the global transformation. And ensure, we need to ensure that the private investments that we have and that we need to additionally mobilize go into the right measures and right investments, ensuring they are all compatible with the Paris Agreement or even contribute to that. That's all fair and good to have. In that regard, the EU also wants to focus on a global investment goal beyond this support component that I spoke about earlier. With a few caveats, you might come to the conclusion that maybe an idea to pursue. But the problem is that this does not solve the problem that we have with the needs or the financing gap from public finance. There are things you cannot ask the private sector to step in to finance it, because in many things you need to pay do not allow for profit in adaptation when it comes to securing, when they're ensuring food security to people, water security, or protecting them from the risks of the worsening climate crisis. These are not sectors where you can generate profit, so you can't use the private sector or private investments for that. Loss and damage is, of course, one of the areas where you absolutely need to have public finance, because you can't rebuild livelihoods rebuild homes and livelihoods, infrastructure and so forth, and have the private sector invest in it, because there's usually, especially in the vulnerable countries, no margin of profit for these. So it's a bit of a distraction to talk about private finance. We absolutely need it. We need to shift the trillions, but not as a replacement for public finance, but on top of it.
Thanks a lot, Jan. And to our listeners, again, if you have just joined us, we're discussing international climate finance and the upcoming negotiations in Baku at COP29 in November this year. If you have any questions to us, to our speakers, please tweet them to @CanEurope, and we'll address them towards the end of this session. So for the next question, we'll go to our director, Chiara Martinelli. So, in all of this, what is the role of the EU, and how do you see the EU's acting and showing up in these negotiations?
Thank you. Thank you so much, Emilia. And I'm building really on what Sindra and Jan already shared about all the different points that are here at stake, and really focusing on the fact that the EU often calls itself a climate champion in international arena especially. And I think it's important to acknowledge and recognize that this has been true, and it's true in certain occasions and opportunity. And in the past years, the EU has been building bridges in international climate negotiations. I can refer, for example, of the moves of last year in making sure that we had a decision on transition away from fossil fuels at COP28. But what is really sad is that when it comes to climate finance, we see a very different picture. And the negotiation on the NSCQGs are not showing that leadership in the last years, and especially in the last weeks. So we need the EU to take a step further and to work the talk in that regard. And as, for example, in engaging finally in discussing a quantum around this goal. Today, we are only 5-6 weeks before the start of COP29, and we would like to emphasize the need for the EU to show such a leadership. and to show efforts that could help in bringing the negotiations forward and not leaving all the details that are important and moral details, as Sindra has been highlighting, to the last days of the negotiations. I also would like to highlight that those kind of moves have been working in the past only if the EU also builds stronger alliances across the different parties in the UNFCCC space. And one example that we have been highlighting is, for example, for the EU to use the next weeks also to reboost and revitalize the Higher Ambition Coalition, or to listening and meeting the most climate vulnerable countries to make sure that we make those alliances concrete as possible. And helping the negotiations moving forward.
So, Chiara, we're talking about considerable sums of money and that the EU also needs to ramp up its contributions. And the question is then, of course, where should this money come from? We hear the EU decision makers talk about limited fiscal space, also in the EU, austerity, limited public funds. And we've seen that, for example, official development assistance for developing countries has been cut recently in many EU countries. So where should this additional money come from?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Emilia. I think this point is building on what we already said in this session about the important roles that, first of all, the public finance needs to play when it comes to that. But also, I think the absolute need, and there is a momentum out there to actually boost everything that is around taxation. So to give concrete example, by taxing the fossil fuel industry or other high emitting sectors, the EU could raise considerable amounts of public money. And I think this is important to keep out there, to give example, to keep working on it, because this will be an essential tool to boost climate finance, but in a fair way, and also in a way that follow the application of the polluters pay principle. I think we do need to give signals also to the EU citizens and the EU public that actually money that can come by the application of the polluters pay principle is essential, is crucial, and is fair for the transition to happen, and actually has a double effect of like tackling the emission reduction target, but also providing the finance needed to for climate finance and for developing countries. Also, I think other options that we also looked at in the Can Europe work lately, and we can share in this space also some of our recent reports, is also taxing, for instance, the wealth and of the super rich, taxing financial transactions or polluting sectors such as air and maritime traffics. So I think that all of this is to say that there is also a great momentum internationally, a lot of discussions going on this regard, and we do hope and we do expect the EU to engage actively in leading those discussions.
Thanks. And again, to our listeners, please, if you have any questions, you can tweet them to @CanEurope. Chiara, question from behind the scenes. You meet with European decision makers and high-ranking officials in Brussels almost on a daily basis. What do you think is their understanding or interest in this topic and the upcoming negotiations?
Yes, this is not a very easy topic for us, like working with EU officials every day. I think it's important to highlight there is a context we are operating that is a post-election context, For the European Union, there is a little bit of, I would say, impasse on everything that could go in the direction of more ambition, both on climate finance and also on emission reductions in general. But I think what is key to highlight here when it comes to international climate finance is that, unfortunately, often policymakers at the EU level are exactly confusing what also Sindra and Jan have been highlighting. The NSCQG is explicitly about finance from developed countries to developing countries. So from rich and historical responsible countries to the countries that are paying the highest impact of climate change. And the tendency we see in those meetings and in those lobby meetings is to broaden the discussion and to look at all kind of financial flows and other types of finance that are needed to solve the crisis. So I think it is our role as experts on those issues and as a civil society to keep highlighting the nature and the essential and moral component of what NSCQG and what public finance that needs to go and to flow from developed countries to developing countries look like.
Thanks. And back to the question of loss and damage. So last year at COP28 in Dubai, we had the decision to operationalize a fund to respond to loss and damage. But now we see there's a lot of resistance from developed countries, including the EU, to actually include loss and damage in the new finance goal. How could this be overcome? Maybe I pass on to Sindra if you'd like to reflect on that.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Amelia. This is, I think that for us in the region as well, it's really important. And there is the argument that the Paris Agreement, the convention, doesn't include loss and damage, but the legal arguments for including loss and damage as a sub-goal within the NSCQG can actually be emphasized via the articles of the convention and the Paris Agreement, and as well as from the previous decisions that have come out from the various COPs. And these do not preclude loss and damage from the scope of the NSCQG. And in fact, these agreements make clear that loss and damage is a need and priority of developing country parties. And this lays a clear foundation in both the Convention and Paris Agreement. So the text is actually there, and it's within the scope of the NSCQG to include this vital component that is essential for equity and justice as well when you're looking at grounding climate finance to be able to address some of the most urgent needs of countries that have contributed the least.
Thanks, Sindra. And I think that this concludes this Twitter space for today. It was our first in a series of Twitter spaces. Discussions in the build up to COP29. So thank you to all our experts for joining. Thank you to the audience, and please stay tuned for our upcoming sessions. One clear message and takeaway, of course, is that international climate finance needs are soaring. The quicker we act, the more manageable the costs will be. And inaction is clearly much, much more costly than acting now and providing the necessary means for all countries to actually implement their climate plans and cope with unavoidable impacts. So for your information, this session has been recorded and will be available later here on our Twitter page for anyone who wants to listen back. With this, thanks a lot, and have a good rest of the day.